Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The XX Gab Fest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX.
Welcome to the XX Gab Fest for Thursday, June 14th, the Muppet Show edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, editor of XX here in the Washington, D.C. studio. I'm joined in the New York studio by our other XX editor, Allison Benedict. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Hannah.
And also Noreen Malone, who writes for the New York Intelligencer blog. Hi, Noreen.
Hey, Hannah.
Our three topics today are, first, we're going to talk about subversive graduation speeches. Second, we're going to talk about a new study that asks if gay parents are just as good as non-gay parents. I was going to say regular parents, and then I stopped myself. And third, are you a chaos Muppet or an order Muppet? A very important question that was raised by our own Dahlia Lithwick, who's going to join us as a guest for the final segment of this show. Let's start with subversive graduation speeches. This came up because of a graduation speech delivered by a Wellesley High School teacher whose name is David McCullough. And it really stood out to me because I had recently watched Rushmore, which, if any of you remembers, it starts with Bill Murray giving this kind of demented graduation speech in which he's, you know, telling the graduates that they need to rebel and not do any of the things that the school tells them to do. And this particular commencement speech, I don't know what you guys thought. I kind of thought it was fabulous when I read the whole thing. I had just read the little clips of it. And it's kind of like you sort of imagine he's drunk up there. Like it was so Bill Murray. You know, he has this, it starts out with this riff about weddings and how weddings are bride-centric pageantry. And it's like wildly inappropriate. You know, he talks about how they're going to go through a midlife crisis. How when they're older, this is like the second paragraph of it. He says, you know, you'll go through a midlife crisis and passably attractive sales reps at trade shows in Cincinnati. And I mean, the reason this got so much attention is something he says later in the speech, which is this phrase, none of you is special. You are not exceptional. And it's a comment. It's a comment on this particular generation and their sense of entitlement, a subject we've talked about before. But it comes across as this kind of like cranky old man melting down on the speech. And as we will talk about, has a kind of, you know, Michael Lewis also gave a speech, which we'll talk about. And then Dave Eggers has a famous graduation speech, which also gives the you are not special message in his own special way. Noreen, what were you moved by the speech? Did you think it was just like an obnoxious old man, you know, haranguing?
I love this speech. I don't think he came across as like that cranky, actually. I think so the part that everyone has picked out is the part at the beginning where it is like pretty much a textbook condemnation of, you know, millennial exceptionalism. But actually is sort of more about their parents. So he says to these high school seniors in Wellesley, which is, you know, a fairly you know, relatively wealthy town. He says, yes, you've been pampered, cosseted, doted upon, helmeted, bubble wrapped. Yes, capable adults with other things to do have held you, kissed you, fed you, wiped your mouth, wiped your bottom, trained you, taught you, tutored you, coached you, listened to you, counseled you, encouraged you, consoled you, and encouraged you. And he goes on. And then the sort of money line is, across the country, no fewer than 3.2 million seniors are graduating about now from more than 37,000 high schools. That's 37,000 valedictorians, 37,000 class presidents, 92,000 harmonizing altos, 340,000 swaggering jocks, and 2,185,967 pairs of Uggs.
Can I just, there's like another money line, which is when he talks about how parents, when you their smile ignite when you walk into a room and hundreds gasp with delight at your every tweet. It's, you know, pretty
yes.
awesome.
So I thought it was great. The reason I thought it was great, despite sort of taking
your
taking these, you know, young people down a peg, is that it didn't come out of a mean place. You know, there are other graduation speeches that I think sound embittered. He genuinely wanted these kids to realize, as a thing that would help them in college and beyond, that, you know, that things are not going to be handed to you on a platter, and that you might not change the world, but that's okay, you know? And that, I think, is a message that gets lost in a lot of graduation speeches and is a really, really valuable one to know as an adult. So I was completely unoffended by it. I know I maybe am supposed to be, as a member of the, like, cosseted, helmeted millennial generation, but I thought it was great advice. And you know, so I don't remember my own college or high school graduation speakers, like, at all. But about 6 months after I graduated, I read the famous David Foster Wallace graduation speech at Kenyon in 2005, in which he talks about sort of the difficulty of adult life, and the beauty of it comes in controlling your thoughts and learning how to be happy, even when things don't go your way, and just, like, and that really moved me and is something that I've taken with me. So I sort of think these subversive graduation speeches are the best kind of graduation speeches to give.
I loved that David Foster Wallace speech, and I read it again last night. It to me is more honest than this David McCullough one, which I also liked. It's very funny. And I when I read it, he did sound kind of, I agree, like a kind of like a crank. And then I saw him in a video clip on the CBS Morning Show, and he's actually like this, seemed to be this lovely, soft-spoken gentleman. He's actually David McCullough's son, the historian David McCullough's son. So he comes from some privilege. he knows what he's talking about in that way. But his speech was great until the end, when I thought it got a little, you know, cliche. He says, don't bother with work you don't believe in anymore. Dream big, work hard. I mean, that stuff is fine,
right,
but it's certainly not subversive. And David Foster Wallace's speech, as a counter to that, didn't say that. It really said, like, live your life in these moments when you're waiting in the checkout line and you want to kill the woman behind you because she has, mm-hmm. you know, she's searching for her coupons, and the woman that's working at the counter at the checkout line can't figure out the code for the apples. Instead of, like, hating the people around you, take that time and, like, think about something. Think about a book, or, you know.
But that was his way of being kind. And, like, McCullough just isn't as gifted of a writer as Foster Wallace,
maybe. That's fair.
But I think both of them in the end came back to the spirit of kindness that I think distinguishes them from being bitter old cranks saying, like, life is tough, kids. Like, you got 70 more years of it left, you know. Like, I didn't get that
sense. The interesting thing, reading these speeches in order, in other words, McCullough's and then Michael Lewis's and this speech by David Foster Wallace – did I say Dave Eggers at the beginning?
Yeah,
I
think you did.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I meant David Foster Wallace. I don't know how we'll edit that in the show.
It's okay. We can
you can make mistakes.
They're of the same generation. His would be like totally
tweed.
They're
both Daves.
I'm sure he's had one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, is that while they're both invectives against narcissism and the fact that anyone is particularly special, because David Foster Wallace starts off in that same vein that we sort of live inside our heads. And what can we do with that? The ultimate conclusion is that these three people giving these speeches are so particular and special, and that their own reality, you know, that these speeches are so much more about them than they are any kind of message to the graduating class, that you come away from them feeling like, I didn't. Like, for example, here on David Foster Wallace's, he starts to talk about, it is not the least bit coincidental that adults who commit suicide with firearms almost always shoot themselves in the head. They shoot the terrible master, and the truth is that most of these suicides are actually dead long before they pull the trigger. That's a very affecting and particular thing to say to a – it seems to me you're lost in your own head if you're talking about that to a bunch of high school kids, just like if you're talking about the passably attractive sales rep. Or in Michael Lewis's case, you know, he's so talking about Michael Lewis. I didn't really believe Michael Lewis's message, which is a slightly different message, that life is all about luck, and that people who are successful spin a narrative of their lives that, you know, they deserved that success. And he's essentially telling these kids, you don't deserve your success. There's no plan laid out. A lot of it is luck.
I totally disagree that these were sort of about them. I mean, they were about themselves, right? That's why they were asked to speak, because they're interesting people who have interesting life experiences they can bring to bear in this situation. But if you look at other graduation speeches, some people just pull out the, like, boilerplate speech that they have been giving, you know, at every speaking engagement they've been asked to give, or they make it about, you know, their company and, you know, the great things that they've been doing. I think that these speakers, like, actually Fareed Zakaria, if I can be totally mean right now, was just in the news because he was caught giving the exact same speech to Duke and Harvard this year. He'd given it to Johns Hopkins and Brown in the past.
Is that really such a crime? I mean, does he really have a different message for
No, I don't think it's a crime. I just think that, you know, he talk about like boilerplate, though. About just being like, all right, here's some inspirational things I'll throw together. Funny. He like had an Art Buchwald anecdote. Just it was, you know, a little bit hackish, if I can be a little judgmental there. But I do really... I think what struck me about these three speeches was the complete opposite of what struck you, Hannah. I just really thought that they were trying to like think about what they would have wanted to hear when they were 22. And of course, like a human being has a very specific set of experiences, whether they are famous or not. But that's sort of what you want to hear is this specific set of experiences. You know, it's
that life is going to become, as David Foster Wallace says, dreary, annoying, some seemingly meaningless
and,
routine.
Well, I don't think David McCullough was saying what he would have wanted to hear when he was 18. He was saying, this is what it's been like to teach you kids who think you're special. And he, I saw him talk about, again, on the CBS Morning Show about, he was saying, like, I'm this kind of parent as well. Like, a lot of this is like an indictment of the way we parent, and he has kids, and he says he treats them as though they're, you know, they're special to him, and he puts them on a pedestal, and so he's,
right. He's,
you know, both aware of this, if you want to call it a problem, or and part of it. His speech actually made me think about how, you know, I try to be the kind of parent who, you know, my kid's just normal, he's just average, I don't think my kid's special, but it's a pose. I mean, it's all like. I don't know how you find that balance between like raising your kids and really believing that, you know, we all think our kids are special and creating these monsters who, yeah, think their every tweet is worth a book deal.
I don't think that's monstrous, though. If your parents don't think you're the most special person in the world, like who does then? I mean, I don't know. I think there's a difference between like having this bedrock self-confidence and having like an inflated sense of ego, but you sort of need someone to give you the inflated sense of ego in order to settle back onto the like bedrock self-confidence.
Right.
The world will cut you down, you know?
But there has to be, what he's talking about is you know, when it goes too far. And
totally.
I struggle with
totally.
That as a, you know, I think we all struggle with that as parents. And I think his speech is much more directed at parents than at kids, and unlike David Foster Wallace's, which is again, like, I don't think what he would have wanted to hear when he was growing up. But as an adult, he can look back and think, like, maybe he wished he had known what drudgery adulthood is.
But, Hannah, weren't you moved? Sorry, I'm still stuck on, like, so the suicide thing, obviously, like, is an extreme example, and I read that as someone whose brain chemistry is very different than his was, but still as someone who has been to the grocery store and has, you know, and has thought a lot about like, you can dwell on this or you cannot, and sort of having the extreme example in front of you is valuable, right? Like,
right.
I don't know.
It's a little bit like it's an amazing speech. It really is amazing. It's an amazing piece of writing. I'm just thinking of it in terms of how the setting that it was actually delivered in, which
right.
is very different than me reading it in my room and thinking how unbelievably moving it is. But it's a little bit like the Go the Fuck to Sleep book, you know?
Yeah.
That it comes from, and this maybe applies more to McCullough, a place where parents feel trapped between the ambivalent instincts that you described, Allison, and so they feel like they're in this frustrating place where they're supposed to be, you know, doing and making their children everything, but that is a kind of annoying place to be, and they don't really know how to get out of it. So it just comes out as this frustration, you know, which is so clear in Rushmore in the Bill Murray speech. And there's a reason why they opened the movie that it's like there's Bill Murray stuck between his, like, you know, dipwad sons who he can't stand but who he's given everything to because he has this money. And so he just comes out in this kind of semi-drunken, you know, speech that he gives to the children at graduation. So it's something like that where it becomes more about the existential position the adults are finding themselves in than because who knows what life is going to be like for these graduates. I mean, you've talked about this, Noreen. It's, you know, that's not the only message to give them that, you know, they have to focus more on their achievements than on accolades because they are coming into a really tough economy. I mean, in some ways, it's kind of a mean speech to give to kids who are walking into the most difficult economy when it's really hard to have any concrete achievements if you're 19 years old right now because you can't get a job and you can't get a foot up on your career. I mean, it's hard. You know, there are external factors and realities besides you've been pampered and everyone's told you that you're really great.
Right. And I think also there's something a little different about a high school graduation speech and a college graduation speech personally. I think, you know, maybe those 4 years you get a little tougher. But I don't know. I don't think he was – I think he was defining achievements pretty broadly and maybe sort of saying that, like, you will achieve things even if the world doesn't recognize them, which I think is a pretty valuable lesson, particularly for this economy. But – and also you're going to remember that speech is the other nice thing about these subversive speeches is that whether – like, even if you're stunned because all of a sudden someone's dropped the word suicide in the middle of, like – you know, your big celebration. Like, at least you will remember. Like, I have zero memory of what was said at either of these things.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I also. Mine was Kofi Annan, but I don't remember it.
Cool. What did you guys think of the Michael Lewis speech?
Well, he was, like, playing with ideas there, right? Like, he sort of at the end acknowledged that he did, like, a double turn and was like, I'm not actually lucky, and I know that, right? He was doing something interesting there that I wasn't sure I like fully was behind. But
can I go back to just one thing in this McCullough speech, the thing that everyone hooked onto, which was, you know, you're not special, none of you are special, and like going forward, you should know this. It occurs to me that like that maybe is the right way to think about yourself if you want to be a good person. But in terms of getting ahead, like in our profession, it is now pretty essential to, like, think you're special, to brand yourself, to become, like, a, you know, a character.
To become a Michael Lewis.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I don't think professional success is the same as being a good person, but it maybe isn't good advice.
Yeah, maybe that's what I'm reacting to so strongly is that, like, I'm sick of hearing that message professionally, so I just, like, I'm so excited to hear it, people pushing against that.
Although if you read his speech closely, what he's saying is that the specialness has to be earned. He does have a line in there saying,
but the specialness doesn't have to be earned.
Well, it's but he's saying, you know, it's not enough to be one of the best. You have to actually be the best. Like, these things are difficult and they take work and achievement. It can't just be that you're all the best just because you're born the best. You actually have to do something. Or is your point, Allison, that you mean that you don't have to do, like, we all should package ourselves as special even before we've done anything?
It's not my point is not that we should.
Right, we do.
Yeah.
Now I'm sort of wondering about his daddy issues, given like his father's fame and his focus on achievement and, you know, lack thereof. But
did you guys know what a YOLO tattoo was? YOLO is
an
old person.
But so YOLO is you only live once, right?
Yeah.
I think, you know, people about 10 years younger than I am are far more into that phrase. That's, you know, that's like an updated version of Carpe Diem, right? Like, just, it sounds like vaguely more like hip. I don't know. But what, Hannah, what did you think of the Michael Lewis speech, though?
Again, I was thinking the idea that Michael Lewis's success is accidental and that it's just because he sat next to the wife of Solon Brothers. I mean, I can tell you a sort of, you know, good luck story of how I got my first job. That's different, you know. Mm-hmm. There's sort of accidents involved in the first time you were put in a good place in the public world. But, you know, many people had a job at Solomon Brothers and are not Michael Lewis. So maybe I'm saying something obvious here, but his voice and his way of telling a story in book after book and circumstance after circumstance, whether it's politics or Wall Street or baseball, is so distinct and special that it's just not believable that his entire career is made up of luck. If he had never gotten that job at Solon Brothers, he would have gotten a job like in baseball and written Moneyball earlier, or he would have gotten a job in the art world and written a brilliant book about arts. Like, it's just he's not the perfect example to me of somebody whose success is based on luck.
But well, could luck be defined as not just like running into the right person, but being lucky enough to have, like, you know, certain institutional advantages, or just being smart, being lucky enough to be smart?
Sure. And I think the striking thing for me about the way Michael Lewis told his own story is that sort of one of his distinctive markers as a writer, right? He sort of makes everything look easy. Like, it,
right.
You seem like it, he does this like tremendous reporting job, and then it just sort of like comes out like a yarn that he's telling in his backyard in his like loafers. White linen pants. Yeah, exactly. And that's sort of how he was like, and this is what happened to me. And it, crazy story, but here, like, you'll be fascinated along the way. Like, sit back, like, have a gin and tonic, enjoy it. You know, that's sort of It was just a very Michael Lewis way of telling the Michael Lewis story.
Right. That is exactly right. I mean, he told this was like a Michael Lewis story about Michael Lewis, whereas the real story about Michael Lewis is that Michael Lewis works unbelievably hard. Of people who are, you know, famous and that successful, his stories, his narratives and his books contain a tremendous amount of reporting, which he travels, he meets people, he finds characters. These things are not easy to do. They're very time consuming. And then he spins them into these effortless seeming stories. So if that speech had been about hard work, it would have been more believable than like, wow, here I am, like young me finding myself seated next to the wife of this person in Germany.
Right, but then we wouldn't be talking about it. Right.
Then we wouldn't be talking about it. Right, it would be a really boring speech about hard work. Okay, on that note, let's move on to our second topic, which is gay parents. But before we do that, I would like to thank our sponsor. The Double X podcast is sponsored this week by Audible, audible.com. It's been a loyal sponsor of a number of Slate podcasts. It is the leading provider of premium digital spoken audio information, offering more than 100,000 audiobooks. Those who listen regularly to the Double X podcast know what a huge fan of Audible I am and how many books I have downloaded on Audible. My recommendation this week is... Hold on. It's breaking the... Oh, sorry. My recommendation this week is to listen to the Michael Lewis books, since we were talking about the hard work and great talent of Michael Lewis, such as The Big Short and Moneyball, both of which are available on Audible and are just fabulous, fabulous reads. I often go back to Michael Lewis books, particularly the introductions of his books are quite brilliant. I mean, he really, really knows how to set up a story. So if you sign up for a 30-day free trial at our special URL, which is audiblepodcast.com/XX, not double X, but XX, and your membership will include a free subscription to either the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. Okay, let's move on to our second topic, which is gay parents. Slate has written a twinned stories about a new study that suggests, because it's gone back and forth in the literature about whether we went from sort of gay parents are inferior to gay parents are superior, and now we've landed in a slightly different spot. And Allison, I'm going to turn to you to explain what this new research shows.
Well, okay, so this researcher, Mark Regnerus, did a study about how gay parents affect their children. And there's been some outcry that it's a flawed and intentionally misleading study because it doesn't measure what it claims to be measuring, which when I opened the study, I assumed it was going to be a study of two-parent gay households. It is not. It is actually a study of young adults between the ages of 18 and 39 who were raised by at least one parent who has had at least one same-sex relationship, which is different. It's a different sample and structure than a two-parent gay household.
And why did he do it this way? I mean, there's a reason he did this. He thought the random sampling would produce a more accurate report than the gay studies, which are often parents kind of reporting on the health and well-being of their children.
And it's a wider possible sample, which
it's a wider possible sample and a less politically loaded thing than if you give gay parents a questionnaire that says, you know, how well are your children doing? That, you know, the political context is such that they're likely to report that their children are doing wonderfully.
So exactly what he's holding up is sort of the strength of the study is what everyone else is picking apart as the weakness, which is sort of interesting. But it found
that parents who are gay, their children are just as likely or more likely to have sort of negative outcomes than children of two-parent straight families. They have children of parents who are gay have similar outcomes as children from broken homes, single parents, other what we'll call non-traditional family structures. This result does not actually surprise me because it's not actually a study of two-parent gay households. So I think that the takeaway from the study is actually that, like, instability is bad for kids.
Right, which we knew already. But, I mean, what Regnerus was sort of setting himself – the history that he was setting himself up against is that I think in 2005 or 2006 there was a big study that came out that said very explicitly, gay parents are no worse than heterosexual parents. And then more recently than that, in fact, a different study came out that in fact said that lesbian couples had the best outcomes of all for their children. So this was sort of, you know, this sort of fits into your general thesis, Anna, that like two women, you know, that why do we need men? You know, two women are, or maybe that's more in doubts.
Well, I think they said that they were less. There's no evidence of abuse. That's the thing. So you know, when we talk
different
about
metrics.
Outcomes, they're actually talking about something fairly specific. When they measure outcomes, they're talking about whether the children, you know, smoke more pot, get into trouble with the law, report more male and female sexual partners, more sexual victimization, and were more likely to reflect negatively on their childhood family life. Those are the things that the Regnerus study studied. Now, Will Salatin of Slate makes the point that, in fact, the Regnerus study confirms that gay marriage is good for children because it measures an era. Since it's measuring adults, it measures adults who were brought up in households long before gay marriage was legal or even really thought about. And so what it's measuring is the detrimental effects of closeted gay relationships and a world in which you could not openly have same-sex marriages in which they weren't sanctioned. And so it proves that, in fact, gay marriage is good for children. Now, he's stretching it a bit there because we don't quite have that evidence. What you need is, you know, very long-term studies comparing children brought up in gay households and children brought up in straight households. But it's my suspicion that the ultimate conclusion will have nothing to do with gayness and straightness, but will have to do with stability.
Right.
And Regnerus says this himself in his piece for Slate. He writes, "The political take-home message of the study is unclear. On the one hand, the instability detected in the study could translate into a call for extending the relative security afforded by marriage to gay and lesbian couples." So he's, you know, he although he's been sort of slimed with making one political argument, he isn't.
Right. And it's a little bit, you know, the sociology went, I think what the sociologists are thinking of gay marriage in the same box that they thought of divorce studies, because divorce studies did flip-flop since the 70s too, where they started in a place saying, oh, children were fine, it's fine, so long as you do these things, it's fine. And then, you know, somewhere in the 90s was the conclusion that that children in divorced households were, you know, tragically worse off. And then that research has landed somewhere in the middle, which is that, you know, it sort of depends on the quality of the divorce and the stability of each parent's relationships with new partners after the divorce. And children may end up slightly worse off on certain outcomes, but it depends on a lot of other factors having to do with stability. But maybe they're thinking that gay marriage has to go through that trajectory as well, although gay marriage is different because it's not the breakup of a relationship.
Well, and I sort of wonder if also maybe adoption studies are more relevant here. The one sliver of his research that I found pretty intriguing was that children reported, and I'm going to get this not quite in the exact words, but, you know, children like to see their own biology in their parents. You know, so if you mm-hmm. have two gay parents and they don't conceive through, you know, they cannot have the same, you know, you cannot be half one parent, half the other. And so that in some of his research, it seemed like kids were a little troubled by that. And so I wonder if like a more interesting comparison might not be with, you know, the way adopted children sort of have these outcomes as they go through life, adopted children in like stable two parent homes.
Right. And as always with this research, you have to think about the motivations of the research. You
right.
know, like, why are we studying the children of gay parents? What's our point in studying these children? What's our point in doing the research in this particular way in which you're looking at, you know, children from maximally broken homes and then suggesting a conclusion about
right.
gay parents?
Right.
Like, you know, there's a problem with that. In the same, you know, we live in a world in which children are produced in lots of different ways. And if you do the research assuming that world exists and is here forever, namely that there are gay parents, there are adopted parents, there are children produced in IVF, there are all these kinds of situations, and they may have implications for children, right? Like a responsible parent in the process of a divorce will likely read literature about children and divorce in order to see how to manage the divorce, you know, to make it best for their children. And one could say that the same could be true of adoptive parents mm-hmm. or gay parents, that like if you're a gay parent about to raise a child, you would responsibly read a lot of good sociology that would say, here are the issues that tend to arise, here are the ages in which it arises, and here's what you can do, right? It's not like, so you want to sense in the research that ahead, not like a resistance, like this is terrible or this is good, you know, it's not like part of the culture war, it's part of our mutual societal effort to produce, you know, the happiest children possible, given the circumstances in which children are now created.
And but, there's no benefit to the gay and lesbian community to, you know, to pretend that they're that all gay parents are in like this happy, shiny four family household. Right. I mean, families are just not like that anymore. Right. Gay, straight, it's just not like that. And so, you know, these previous studies, like we talked about, have perhaps presented a certain image of what gay families are like, and it's we should be honest about what all families are like.
The modern family version of it. But it is, you know, Hannah, to your point, it is being taken up in the culture wars. Like Ross Douthat, you know, premised a whole big column about you know, sort of picking through Begnaris's research and saying, you know, coming to a conclusion at the end, like, oh, we don't know yet what this means for gay marriage, with the implication being like, oh, I do know what it means for gay marriage, you know?
Right.
So they don't exist in a – unfortunately, they don't exist in a vacuum where parents, you know, just sort of try to figure out how to be better parents.
Yeah, I feel like we're 10, 15 years away from that, frankly. Like now we're in a moment of honesty about divorce. The divorce research is actually – is a little – is pretty devoid of, you know, ideological taint. It's just research about divorce and children. And I think that will happen with gay families, but not for a while. Like for a long time, like people are going to point to this lesbian study saying, you know, gay parents are better. Like, honestly, is it that like surprising to you that lesbian couples have less violence in their relationships? I mean, that seems like not such an amazing conclusion. It doesn't really say anything more about the happiness or comfort of children raised in gay families. And I think, you know, for gay families, obviously it's a different situation. There are lots of issues that will come up if you're a boy raised by two moms or a girl raised by two dads or whatever. Like, it's obvious that there are particular issues that one has to think about. But I think the gay community is probably, you know, a few years away from being not completely defensive about that situation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's move on to our last topic, for which we want to call Dahlia Lithwick and talk to her about chaos theory, whether we are chaos Muppets or order Muppets. Hi, Dahlia.
Hi there.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm going to read a little description in your brilliant chaos theory piece about Muppets. Dahlia divides the world into two kinds of Muppets, the chaos Muppets and the order Muppets, and proposes that each of us are one of these Muppets. And when I liked this piece and tweeted it, all of my friends immediately jumped on, as I'm sure happened to everyone. It's like, I'm a chaos Muppet. I'm an order Muppet. I'm married to an order Muppet. So it's a theory that really resonates with people. I'll just read a little description. Chaos Muppets are out of control, emotional, volatile. They tend towards the blue and fuzzy. They make their way through life in a swirling maelstrom of food crumbs, small flaming objects, and the letter C. And then she names a few of the chaos Muppets, namely Animal, who's the first chaos Muppet that comes to mind when I think of them. Order Muppets, and I'm thinking about Bert, Scooter, Sam the Eagle, Kermit the Frog, and the blue guy who's perennial harassed by Grover at restaurants, tend to be neurotic, highly regimented, averse to surprises, and may sport monstrously large eyebrows. One more sentence. Because I love this sentence. They sometimes resent the responsibility of the world weighing on their felt shoulders, but they secretly revel in the knowledge that they keep the show running. I know lots of such people. I'm not one of them. Anyway, Dahlia, where did this theory come from? Is this something you've talked about with your loved ones for years and years, or so? Where did you think of it?
It's totally something that my husband and I have used to organize marital strife for years and years. And you know, it's one of those things that never occurred to me would be relevant to other marriages. It just seemed that the minute we established many years ago, I think even before we had children, that he was an order Muppet and I was a chaos Muppet, nothing else ever needed to be said. It was the framing necessary to have a healthy marriage.
So give me an example. Would it come up in an argument? Because, you know, I don't when I look at your husband, I don't immediately think order Muppet, you know?
Right. Well, my husband, he's tricky because he's a sculptor and he gives off slight chaos Muppet vibes. But then, Hannah, if you ever watch him go shopping, it's the exact same 19 products in the same ratios every time. And he will joyfully walk by the fresh mangoes because he doesn't buy mangoes. So he's an order Muppet in every way. And so then he will come home and start unpacking and I'll say, where's the one surprising, interesting fish product you might have purchased? And he'll just look at me like I'm Cookie Monster. So this right. has been sort of an ongoing dialectic. And you know, in fairness, when I come back with groceries and forget milk and eggs but have only 400 mangoes, again, Chaos Muppet. So,
Chaos Muppet. Yeah. Now, is there a gender angle to this? Do you think men are more likely to be order Muppets, particularly within the confines of marriage when we tend to exaggerate each other's, you know, characteristics and sort of the nuances fade away over many years of marriage? So are men more likely to be the order Muppets?
You know, that's one of the interesting things I noticed. I just first want to say that I wrote this piece only because I didn't want to write the piece I was supposed to be writing. So I didn't really give a lot of thought to, you know, that this might resonate with other people. But with that caveat, I will say that the feedback I've had is really interesting because everybody wants to be a Chaos Muppet. Suspects and fears that they might be really an order Muppet. So I think there is some gender component where women want to be Chaos Muppets and men want to be order Muppets. But I don't think gender sorts that way. But I do think that men aspire to be sort of organized and in charge. So even if they're Chaos Muppets, they think they're order Muppets and vice versa with women.
Well, I was thinking, is it one of those things where everyone has elements? Because a Chaos Muppet presumably has some charisma, which is necessary to leadership, right? Like, there is a way in which Order Muppet doesn't necessarily scream leader. Sometimes it screams functionary. It depends how you look at it.
I think that's right. I also think that, you know, I'm a little worried that there's going to be the first Chaos Muppet Order Muppet divorce filing as a result of this piece. I mean, I'm getting a lot of angry emails from friends who are describing the men in their lives in the spice racks and how now that they know that he's an order Muppet, it might all be over. So yeah, there might be really ugly marital law implications to this piece that I had not anticipated.
I have a question.
Now, Allison and Noreen, can you jump in on which one you are, would you say?
Yeah, no, I've been trying to figure this out. I think I'm a Chaos Muppet, but now I'm worried that, like, I just want to be a Chaos Muppet.
Right.
But I think I'm a type A Chaos Muppet, if that makes sense. Like, I've learned to be regimented, but it's tough. It's tough for me.
Yeah, that's about where I am.
I'm pretty sure I'm a pretty classic order Muppet.
Oh, really?
I mean, I'm neurotic, and I don't always achieve the order that I'm going for. That's definitely true. But yeah, I'm an order Muppet. My husband is definitely an order Muppet who has in the past become obsessed with Quicken to the point that when I would walk in the house every day from work, he would just look at me and say, "Do you have any receipts?"
Yeah,
I'm curious what you would say. You said that if two Chaos Muppets marry, they get Elmo. What about two Order Muppets?
I think I wrote that if any two of the same marry, they get Elmo.
Anyway, you get Elmo.
What's so bad about Elmo?
Well, it was just really an incredibly unspeakable whack at Elmo. I loathe. And as someone, you know, who was a generation that grew up pre-Elmo, the idea that they would foist Elmo on us and call him a Muppet just offends.
I'm with you on that one.
Oh, you guys didn't have Elmo?
No.
Whoa.
Whoa.
We also didn't have
and
Abby.
I didn't have Abby. I'm not that young, please.
E-L-M-O. I've had that doll in my house for a long time.
I love this. When I was reading around about other people having written about the Muppets, there's a college paper that someone wrote on the psychological disorders of Sesame Street characters, and Cookie Monster is a classic binge eater. The Count and Bert are obsessive compulsive. Big Bird is a schizo because his delusions of Snuffleupagus, who himself is suffering from depression.
It's amazing.
That you can sort of look at the world in this way.
Now, one thing I couldn't figure out either is there an implied hierarchy or not? Like, in other words, is there an implication here that one of these is better than the other? Or not really?
I think there is an implication that Chaos Muppets are more fun and unpredictable. I mean, who doesn't love Ernie more than Bert, right? But right. I think that the idea is that if you are a true Order Muppet, you revel in your Order Muppetry, and everybody else understands.
Is incompetent.
That it's better to be a Chaos Muppet. But again, I don't want to imply for one second that any rational thought went into this piece.
Well, I think what made it attractive, like, typically with these binaries, like type A, type B, like, being described as a type B isn't exactly a compliment, but you could definitely take either of these as a compliment, you know? And I think that's maybe why people sort of responded to it a little bit.
As an Order Muppet, I would say that the way that you described an Order Muppet, and there are things about it that resonated with me that convinced me I'm an Order Muppet, I actually would judge as being sort of negatives. And I'm talking myself, too. But, yeah, I mean, who wants to be neurotic and...
It's not neurotic. It's competent.
Okay.
Like competent to, like, a shining degree.
I think the two necessarily go hand in hand.
Well, I'm neurotic, too, but I'm a chaos Muppet.
Well, my husband would be the first to tell you that being outed publicly as an Order Muppet when you're trying to be recognized as a sculptor is not... nobody really wants a competent sculptor.
Yeah,
so he's less than delighted with me. I will also add that my children, one of whom is a classic Order Muppet, the 7-year-old, and the other is a classic Chaos Muppet, both believe that they're Chaos Muppets. So I think at least as far as children are concerned, there is absolutely nothing grosser than being called Kermit or Bert.
Do you think any actual Muppets are suffering under the delusion that they're an Order Muppet when they're actually a Chaos Muppet or vice versa?
Wow, Muppet false consciousness.
Yeah, let's go there.
Yeah, I think Beaker, you know, the more I've thought about this, I think Beaker constantly finds himself in chaos situations, but it's chaos that's being foisted upon him. And so even though his hair is always exploding and he presents as a chaos Muppet, I think he would tell you, if he could speak, that he is an order Muppet.
Well, the tension that I love in this theory is that, you know, chaos is attracted to order and order is attracted to chaos. The classic example being in HBO Girls, Marnie and Hannah, you know, one the Order Muppet, one the Chaos Muppet. But as the series goes on, you know, Hannah is searching for more kind of structure and order, and Marnie is searching to unleash herself a little bit. And so they're just mutually, they're drawn to each other.
I thought you were going to come up with something from like the Bible or Shakespeare, and you were like, and in
right.
girls.
And in girls. The classic text.
Cain is an order Muppet and Abel is a chaos Muppet.
You know, you laugh, but I did get a Facebook post from somebody on Sunday who was using this as the basis for his sermon.
Oh my gosh.
In church. So I await eagerly the text of his sermon, and I will.
I think probably the problem is how you started the piece. You know, I'm sure I know it was arch, and it was totally brilliant, but it was like, it very much made it, you know, said not, people don't always get the joke, you know, so people could think this is larger than you intended it to be.
I think that's probably right.
Yeah, okay. I will say I'm a Chaos Muppet married to an Order Muppet, so it really, you know, it resonated with me for sure.
Well, I'm a Chaos Muppet who works for the same Order Muppet, so.
Yeah, although he does have chaos hidden within and I have order hidden within, but whatever, you know. I'm trying to tap into my inner order as much as I can. So do we have any more questions for Dahlia? I've sort of run out of questions. I'm thinking... We can cut this part from the show, but does anybody have any more questions? I'm trying to think of, is there any other areas where we can talk about, like, TV shows or classic
characters? Wait, I want to talk about the Supreme Court thing, maybe, because that was interesting.
All right, let's bring that up. Okay. All right. That's the last thing, Dahlia. So, Dahlia, the Supreme Court and Chaos and Order, you dropped in a few Supreme Court names because you know these ladies and gentlemen so well. Do you think it actually has implications for their judicial philosophies?
Well, I was careful to say that I think the only two sitting Chaos Muppets are one liberal and one conservative, that is Stephen Breyer and Antonin Scalia. So I wanted to be very careful to say that Chaos and Order transcend political and ideological positions. But I do think this is a way too orderly Supreme Court in every way, and uptight and neurotic and closed off. And so, yes, I am a big believer that we need far more Chaos Muppets with their, you know, adulterous affairs and their crazy gibberings and extracurricular madness.
Just for better copy?
Pardon me?
For better copy?
For better copy.
Are Chaos Muppets more activist or less activist?
Like, oh, that's a good question. That is clearly the follow-up piece. and also whether Order Muppets are originalists. These are good, hard-hitting doctrinal questions that I have not yet probed. But
well, the one thing this piece explained to me is why I continue to sort of to have a little bit of love for Scalia, because he's an originalist, so he's, at some level, he is drawn to order, but he is in his soul in the way he writes you know, digressive and large and charismatic and clearly has a lot of chaos going on. And that's, it's so bracing and excellent to read. So we need some of those.
And you said that Elena Kagan, was it Elena Kagan who you're not sure if she's Order or Chaos yet?
Yeah, I think it's too soon to tell. And I think she does have a quirky, there's a possibility there's a great cloud of cookie crumbs around her.
Yeah, she gives off a chaos vibe.
Yeah, really? a little bit. So I think she has some chaos potential. I'm hoping that that really kind of explodes into being in the next couple of terms.
Excellent. We will look forward to that. Well, Dahlia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very, very much for having me.
Sure. Manamana. Well, that is the end of our show. Let's move on to our coffee talk recommendations. Noreen, why don't you go first this week?
Sure. I have been listening to – well, first of all, actually, I have a Muppet – I have a vaguely Sesame Street-related recommendation, but it's actually about Mr. Rogers. I think of the two as basically the same thing because they ran back-to-back when I was growing up. But there is an amazing Mr. Rogers, like, mashup that made the rounds this week. That was actually put out by PBS, their like digital video making arm, and it is the trippiest thing ever. It's just like Mr. Rogers saying weird things about consciousness, like that he actually said on his show with like trippy music and talking about the garden of your imagination, just edited into this like can't look away 3-minute web video that I loved. And if you grew up on Mr. Rogers, you will probably love it too.
I saw it. It was completely amazing.
Right?
You're right. I mean, I had forgotten how much he strayed in that direction. You know,
yeah.
Like I remember the vibe of Mr. Rogers, but that the words were so trippy that way. I hadn't quite remembered that.
Well,
really,
and you don't,
good.
I think you don't realize it as a little kid. You just, because you are sort of like, yeah, the world is a weird and amazing thing place. And I am discovering stuff all the time, you know? So it's like little kids and people on shrooms like have a lot in common. But so the other thing that, that I've been listening to this week is the new Fiona Apple album, mm-hmm. Which, I'm in the tank for Fiona Apple, but I think it delivers, and it's streaming right now on NPR's website, and I think it's out in a couple weeks. But the title alone is amazing. It's called The Idler Wheel is Wiser Than the Driver of the Screw, and Whipping Cords Will Serve You More Than Ropes Will Ever Do. And she's sort of famous for having long Baroque titles for her albums. But yeah, it's great. The first song and the last song in particular, I recommend.
And the New York Times did a pretty good interview profile of her. In the last couple of weeks that you could look up to.
She looks strikingly older, not older in a bad way, but she just, you know, the sort of original video of her in Criminal, she looked very teenage, and now she looks like an adult woman, but like still with those like haunting eyes. And I don't know. It's just
been, how long has it been? I mean, it's a long time.
15 years?
Records. Yeah.
20 years almost? No, 15.
No, yeah.
Yeah, that was sort of the theme of the profile, like Fiona Apple all grown up and what's changed.
Yeah.
I almost never do this, but I'm going to have a Slate recommendation, especially since we've had such a Slate-centric show. But at XX, we've been running this series of essays from women who never wanted to have children. And I'm really the last person who should be moved by such a series, given my large number of children. And in fact, my daughter always makes fun of me about this series, like, oh, sorry, I can't edit your story because I have to go to my daughter's theater performance in Taekwondo. Oh, sorry, I'll get back to you later. And so, but I kind of, you know, I find it moving to read these essays, which Allison has been curating and also putting up on the blog, and, you know, just people expressing this wish, you know, and sort of thinking about my own emotional and personal reactions to people saying such things about children. It has a very eavesdroppy feel for me, like, oh, this is what they've always thought about me, and this is what people are thinking as they're walking down the street. But there is also something refreshing about people expressing this desire or lack of desire, which I think it's kind of hard for women to do historically. And well, they are being judged for it, I should say. I was going to say and not being judged for it, but there's like 3,000 comments.
Oh, yeah. I can't imagine the comments.
Insanely judgmental. So, you know, sorry about that. But anyway, it's been an interesting experience to do that. Allison.
I am recommending Gillian Flynn's new book, Gone Girl, which I'm actually recommending without having finished it. I'm almost done, so I suppose there's a slight possibility that next podcast I might say, wait, the ending was terrible. But Gillian Flynn is a sort of thriller mystery writer. She used to be the television critic at Entertainment Weekly. And I've never read anything she's written previously, but the Times described the book as ice pick sharp, and I would say that's pretty accurate. It's a crime story, it's a mystery, it's a thriller, but mostly it's this amazing dissection of a marriage and about the personalities we all try on as we go through life and as we try to keep our marriage alive. And it's also about the murder of a wife. I won't go any farther than that, but I highly recommend it.
Sounds great.
Sounds great. It really does. Well, thank you both for joining me today. Thanks to Chris Wade for engineering this podcast. Thank you to Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts. As usual, please join us on the XX Facebook page for recommendations of what we should talk about next. Also, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes so that other people can know you're subscribing and become listeners. And also make sure to leave a comment while you're there. Thank you very much, and we will see you in a couple of weeks.